This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and I know anyone and everyone has been reminding you to exercise your right to vote. But when we all understand what so many have endured to preserve that right, perhaps it sinks in a little more deeply. Like the last veteran you were listening to moments ago, Ruben Ramirez, Francis Asbury had an older brother also serving in World War II. Francis was in the Navy, serving as a radio man and gunner on PB-4Y-1 and PB-4Y-2 bombers with VPB-106 in the Pacific. Just try to imagine being in his shoes as you follow along with what he survived in World War II.
I never wondered if I'm going to get killed or something like that. Like I say, I guess I was too dumb and happy to realize what was going on, and I knew we had to do something, and you just did it. After we were in New Guinea, a little island called Wadki,
yeah,
we did our last bombing right in there and had bombed that little island before we landed there.
Uh-huh.
But that was our last trip. We came back to the States and had to leave and went up to Hutchinson, Kansas for about 6 weeks. Then went back to San Diego and reformed the squadron. What they did, they took half the squadron and created two new squadrons. And then we went back in September or October of 44.
With new planes, right?
We had new planes, but that was our problem when we went down, because we were flying an old B-24 that had a lot of hours on it.
Ah.
And what they were trying to do is to save hours on our new planes.
What was the purpose of you going up in the B-24 that day?
They were doing patrols out of there, so we were just on regular patrol.
Looking for submarines or ships or something?
Ships, mainly.
Do you remember the date?
That we went down? I never forget it.
I didn't think so.
December 19, 1944. We were out probably a little over 300 miles from Hawaii. The number one engine caught on fire, and we're going to have to go down. And I'll tell you a story, and you can... I had a real good buddy on there, and when we found out we were going to go down, we all had life jackets. And he came up to the flight deck, and he said he didn't have one. I mean, we didn't have a spare. We looked around and couldn't find another one, and later on we did. And instead of staying at the radio, I had my second radio man get on, and I took the life jacket back to him in the back, and I was standing up when the plane hit. So I have no idea how I got out. I must have gone out head first.
So I want to get a sense for this, being on this plane, because you've flown all these missions, and as you're telling me, you really haven't had any scares.
No.
Right? You haven't run out of gas. You haven't had any rough landings. You haven't been shot at, really, at least not by enemy aircraft, maybe from ground fire.
Any aircraft.
So you're getting the ack-ack from down below.
Right.
But you hadn't been shot up?
We only got hit once really good. We had a hole in the tail about that big around.
About 18 inches in diameter?
Yeah.
That's big enough. That's getting hit pretty good.
Well, apparently the shell went through and did not explode.
Good thing, or you wouldn't be here.
That's right.
So that had happened. That was your closest call to this point.
Right.
But now you're in this B-24. The engine's on fire. And is your captain on the radio telling you to prepare to evacuate?
No, you don't bail out.
You're going to try to make a water landing.
You have to.
Uh-huh.
When you're over water that far out, you don't ever bail out.
Uh-huh.
You'd have 11 guys strung over 11 miles.
All separated.
All separated.
Yeah.
It's your only chance of survival is to stay together.
So he tells you, prepare for a crash landing on the water. But you figure out there's not enough life jackets, and your good buddy didn't have one.
Yeah, and I figured I had time to take it back to him.
And what was his name?
Red Vandergriff.
So you go from the top turret to where?
Back in the back part of the plane.
Toward the tail.
Yeah, by the two turrets, two open 50s.
So you've just handed him the life jacket, and you don't have time to prepare for crash position.
Handed him the life jacket, and that's the last I remember.
You just blacked out. So the plane hits, and you're basically knocked unconscious.
Oh, yeah.
So you have no idea how you made it from inside the tail of that plane to the water?
No idea.
Where were you when you came to?
I was in the water, and I saw the life raft, and Red was in it, and I was able to manipulate and get close enough, or he was getting close enough to me, to where he could pull me in.
Wow.
Actually, really being hurt, I was the only one on the plane that was hurt. I'll take that back. We lost 8 guys out of 15.
Oh, you had 15 that day.
Yeah. We had four guys that went over aboard ship, and they had not had in their 4 hours of flight pay. You got to fly 4 hours a month in order to earn flight pay. So they went up in order to get 4 hours. Yeah, three of them went down with the plane.
Uh-huh.
And one of them got out.
So of the 15 on board, eight are killed. And you come to, you're floating in the water. I mean, if you had taken longer to come to, you might not be here, huh? You had a life jacket that was keeping you afloat?
I had a life jacket on.
I mean, did you even know what had happened or who you were or where you were?
Oh, yeah. I knew what was going on, and I knew we were down and that we were in trouble.
So you see red in the raft, and you're able to kind of paddle your way over?
Mm-hmm.
But you're hurt. You can already feel that there are some injuries.
Oh, yeah. I've got my face smashed in. I can't see out of my right eye. I've got a broken arm, compound fracture of this arm, and I lost a lot of teeth.
Lost a lot of blood, I bet.
Probably, yeah, lost a lot of blood, but mainly it was my face and this compound fracture of this bone and this bone here to where?
Around your eye, the orbital bone?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
So my eye sunk down, but there's compound fracture of both of them. And my nose, my upper jaw was shattered, my lower jaw was shattered.
So basically, your face looks like it got sledgehammered.
Yeah. I'll show you the pictures.
Well, I'll make sure we put those at hometownheroesradio.com so everybody listening can look at them. Could you feel all that pain, or were you kind of numb to some of it?
Actually, I wasn't numb, really. The only thing that hurt was my arm. Anytime I moved it or anybody touched it, it hurt. As far as my face and all these bones that were broken in there, I had no pain.
Wow.
It's amazing.
So you get to the raft, and Red helps you into it?
Oh, yeah.
And can you see anybody else?
See the other guys hanging on the side.
Of the raft?
There were always three of us in the raft. I was in the middle and one on each end. It was only a two-man life raft, really.
But they put you in the middle because you were the most severely injured.
Yeah. The other guys hung on the side.
Uh-huh.
And then they all took turns switching around over a couple of days.
And what time of day was it when you crashed?
Very nice day.
What? Middle of the day, like afternoon or something?
I would say very early afternoon.
Uh-huh.
Right afternoon.
I imagine you had some perspective on this, because you've already done a whole tour in the Pacific flying these patrols where you're looking for enemy ships and you're looking for submarines, and I imagine occasionally you were looking for downed American airplanes, right?
Yes.
Now you guys are a downed American airplane.
You're right.
So you're dependent on someone who had been doing what you were doing to find you.
Hopefully.
Well, and that's my question. How much hope did you have? Knowing what you'd seen and what you were familiar with, did you think you guys would get picked up?
Absolutely not. When you're 300 miles from land in a two-man life raft, three-man life raft, you don't expect to get picked up. You're just lucky when you get spotted.
If you get spotted.
If you get spotted, you're just lucky. We didn't have any sharks, fortunately.
But you didn't know that.
No. But our hope was just being picked up.
When the sun set that first night, was that kind of a downer?
Yeah, I guess so. You're just sitting there wondering, are you going to get spotted?
Had the pilot had time to send out an SOS?
Oh, yeah, we sent out.
Or you probably did, huh?
I had, and then my radioman continued. Yeah, they had a pretty good idea of where we were at the time, except one thing was bad about it. It was a rough sea, and you really move around a little bit. I guess it was the 3rd. We went down on the 19th, and I think it was the 21st. We spent two nights out there. And then this Navy PBM happened to come by. We had a smoke bomb, lit the smoke bomb, and the pilot spotted it.
Wow.
His name was Glenn Welch. We actually contacted him after it was all over.
Wow.
The most beautiful sight in the world is being out there and seeing a plane several miles even with you and banked towards you. Then you know you got something going.
Yeah, this is incredible. And I've got a lot of questions for you. One on that smoke bomb. Did you have more than one, or was that the only one you had?
I'm not sure.
Because if that's your only one, you better make sure they see it.
That's right.
And you just told us, you said it very matter-of-factly, but this is a big, scary, insane deal. You spent two nights, overnight, twice, in the water, in this life raft, nothing to eat or drink, right?
Well, we had one can of water, and it was open, and my Second radioman took a sip of it. If you've ever taken a drink of water out of a can, you know it's not good. And he took a swallow of it and said it wasn't good, threw it overboard.
Oh, man.
Believe it or not.
Wow. And we all know what happens if you drink any of the salt water.
Oh, yeah.
You're just accelerating the inevitable.
Yeah, you don't do it. Don't drink that.
So overnight, two nights, in severe pain, all these broken bones, your face smashed in, your arm rendered unusable, not knowing if anyone's going to pick you up. And there were three of you in the raft and four hanging on?
Mm-hmm.
How did you guys get through that? What kinds of things were you talking about, or how did you support each other to survive that ordeal?
Well, there was a lot of quietness. I had a funny thought. When it came back from the first time, you don't have any place to spend your money overseas. So when we came back, I had pretty good chunk of money coming. And during that 3 or 4 months that we were back in the States, before we went back out, I spent a lot of money and I had a good time. And one of my main thoughts was that that was a pretty dumb thing to do, because my parents didn't have a lot and they sure could have used that money.
Hmm.
And then my second thought was, they're going to get my insurance, so it's okay now.
Wow.
I'm glad I spent it.
Were some guys starting to panic?
No, I don't think there was any. It was all pretty calm and very quiet. You're just sitting there listening, hoping to hear a plane. And the plane that spotted us could not land because of the rough water. And there was a radio ship pretty close by, I think. And anyway, from the afternoon, this weather ship got to us, and it was still daylight, because I have pictures of that. They got to us and picked us up, and then later that night, we transferred to a destroyer, and the destroyer took us into Pearl Harbor to the hospital.
As that time went on and on and on, and those hours dragged on and on, did you have that thought? Maybe I'm never going to be picked up?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think any of us thought we ever would be, because, like I say, you got a small life raft 300 miles from land. What are the chances of finding it?
Yeah, that's beyond the needle in the haystack.
That's right.
And so were you resigned to not making it? Were you praying that you would?
Well, we were still hoping, yes. We were hoping that somebody would spot us. But you never give up hope in a situation like that.
And on Christmas Day, while your folks are back home in Oklahoma thinking they've lost a son, what are you doing?
I'm getting operated on.
They're trying to fix your face.
Mm-hmm. But fortunately, there was a nurse there that went to the same high school that I did, that she was about 2 years ahead of me in school, maybe three. But she was a nurse there, and she happened to be on the ward where they took me, and she wrote my parents and told them I was okay.
Wow. I wonder what your mother's face was like when she got that letter.
I have no idea. No idea. I was in the hospitals a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Yeah, but a lot of that was unnecessary, because the doctor put steel plates in my arm and they didn't get the bones touching.
Ew.
And they have to touch in order to knit. So I ended up in Bethesda having three bone grafts, and each one of them take a month to heal. So in between there and when we got back to the States, and my dad told me that my brother had been killed, then I went to the chaplain and the Red Cross and asked that I be sent to Norman, Oklahoma. Well, they sent me to Corpus Christi, Texas. And I was down there, I'm going to guess, probably a month. And I did the same thing. I went to the chaplain and Red Cross, told him my story. I said, I want to go to Norman, Oklahoma. And they made arrangements, and they sent me up there. But when I got there, there was no plastic surgeon. So I had to wait there for several weeks in order to be transferred to National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, where they had plastic surgeons. So if you sit down and figure all that out, there's got to be 5 to 6 months in there where it really wasn't necessary because of situations.
I wonder, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head, but I wonder if it was good that you had that time to process everything you'd been through and what happened to your brother. And maybe you can help explain what happened to your brother. I know you didn't find out for quite a while afterwards, but he's a P-47 pilot,
right?
Fighter pilot in Italy, where they did tons of bombing and strafing missions, flying every day, if not twice a day.
Yeah, he had 129 missions when he was killed.
He probably had some significant decorations, too, after all those missions.
He was decorated pretty good. And then, unfortunately, what happened was, at the end of 125, they could go home. And they asked for volunteers to do a few more flights. And he, unfortunately, volunteered. And if he quit at the end of his 125, then he would have been all right.
And by talking to guys who were in his fighter squadron, you were able to understand what happened to him that day? Explain that to us. What happened?
Well, they were out strafing, and they had some bombs on, and I don't know what they were bombing. But anyway, he had a bomb that hung up on his wingtip, and he also spotted this ammunition bomb, which he made a dive bomb on it, trying to shake the bomb off. And unfortunately, he shook it off. And he was down pretty low, and it exploded and knocked off his tail section. So he spun in. This was near Lake Garda in Italy.
Hmm. Is he buried there in Italy?
He was, and my mother raised so much cane with my dad, she wanted to bring him back to the States. So in 1950, we brought him back to the States. Buried him in Tulsa.
So that happened to him in February of 1945. But you didn't find out for a couple months after that.
No, I think I found out in April when I came back to the States from Hawaii.
What was that like to get that news?
Oh, that was probably the worst feeling I ever had in my life when my dad told me that. Because we really were close. We were only 1 year. He was 21 months older than I was, but he was only 1 year ahead of me in school. And we did everything together. I was sort of the little brother, I guess. But that's the worst news that I have ever had in my life.
You know, and I often ask veterans to consider the odds or explain how they survived something. And you went through an unbelievable ordeal that the odds were against your survival. And you never would have married your wife. You wouldn't have had your three daughters. These grandkids wouldn't be here. And I'm sure you're thrilled about all of that, but I'm sure that's also tempered by what happened to your brother. Has that been hard to wrestle with over the years?
Oh, I've thought of him every day.
Every day.
Every day.
And I'm looking across. There's an open door here to your bedroom, and there is a big picture on the wall of an Army Air Corps officer.
That's him.
That's got to be Leon.
That's him.
Have you ever thought about what his life would have been like if he survived the war?
I've wondered, and you can't really wonder. I'm sure he would have been married and had a family, but what he would have done, I have no idea. But I sure wish I could have found out. It's the ultimate sacrifice.
Indeed it is. And in Leon Asbury and Hank Ramirez, you've heard about two of the more than 406,000 Americans who made that ultimate sacrifice in World War II. More than a million when you go back through all the wars in our nation's history. You've heard it from two recipients of the Purple Heart, and you're going to meet another who certainly understands both the price and value of freedom after living in the absence of freedom for the final months of World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.